In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about uranium, something that certainly has altered the course of history and helped make the modern world the place that it is, maybe for sometimes for good and sometimes not. The involvement of humans with uranium, however, interestingly enough, goes back even to ancient times, although its potential and danger perhaps only were realized in the late 19th century with the discovery of radioactivity. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about this element, something a little bit about where it comes from and its role in global politics. And our guest for the program is Tom Zollner. He's the author of a recently published book. The title is Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World. It is published by Viking and is out now if you want to take a look at it. He's the author of an earlier book, and in fact, we talked about it here on this program, a book about diamonds. The title of that book is The Heartless Stone. He has worked as contributing editor at Men's Health and also reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's joining us by phone. And as we talk, as always, questions are welcome. You will just come here right to the program, as usual. And that number, our number to call in, is 333-9455. And toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you pick up the telephone and give us a call. Mr. Zollner, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. The stuff that ends up either in nuclear weapons or in nuclear reactors is a product that has to be processed. But if we had, say, if I had some uranium ore here on the table in front of me, the rock, it was just sitting here, would there be anything about it that would seem unusual or that would call your attention to it, or would it essentially just seem like pretty much like a rock?
Very much the latter, and it would be largely useless and harmless, in fact, unless you were going to pound it up and do a line of it, if you like. that would leave you at risk for cancer. But other than that, it's fine. There's a saying that I heard from a number of uranium miners that they would shovel some of it into a pillowcase and sleep on it. It's that harmless.
So the ore itself is it in fact radioactive?
Yes, but it's at a very low level to the point where proximity to it is really harmless unless. You're going to be breathing the dust, and this is what happened, breathing the dust over time, I should say, and this is what happened in the 1950s and 60s that caused the deaths of many hundreds of uranium miners and people who worked in uranium mills, is that they were inhaling this dust, and that proved deadly over the long run.
And certainly, yeah, we would not want to minimize the hazards that have been associated, as you say, with either being a uranium miner or working in the processing of uranium. Because,
well, it's much safer than it used to be, but you know, this is one of the dark sides of the Cold War, which has many dark sides, but one of them is that the U.S. government knew about these risks and nevertheless did not do anything to ensure the safety of the uranium miners in the American West. And so many hundreds died as a result, and the U.S. government later made recompense for this, recognized that this was this had been a preventable tragedy and made compassion payments to these guys.
Mm. So where does most of the uranium in the world come from? That is, if you ask them the question, well, where is it they're digging it out of the ground? Where would that be?
The number one producer is Canada, followed by Australia, followed then by Kazakhstan.
Mm. And is all uranium ore the same, or is some more, say, more desirable than others?
Uranium ore comes in a number of expressions, most often in association with oxygen. It's very friendly to oxygen, its outer layer of electrons, and so you get these different shades of uranium. It's known to produce colors up and down the spectrum, and the effect is really quite remarkable. But that has nothing to do with its radioactivity. That has to do with its oxidation.
Hmm. I think it's interesting, you know, you look at the history of uranium, I suppose there's one major dividing point, and that is at the point where people discovered radioactivity and started to do experiments with it, so that there was maybe the point before and the point after. The point after is when we get into things like the first sustained chain reaction and nuclear weapons. Before that, it was a different thing, but human beings have been aware of uranium. Maybe they weren't completely aware of what it was and its chemical properties and its radioactive properties, but it was something that people knew about and actually did things with going back to the ancient world.
Yeah, that's right. It was known as a coloring agent, you know, a stain for glass. Native Americans in the West used it for ceremonial reasons because of that oxidation effect that I was telling you about. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the late 1930s that its radioactive powers were fully understood, especially its ability to create what's called a chain reaction.
Yeah, and I suppose some people may have heard of this in case they thought it was some sort of urban legend. It has indeed been used to color ceramics, and it is in fact true that at one point there was, and I think it was just one color, of what had been a popular ceramic, the stuff called Fiesta ware. There was indeed some Fiesta ware that used this, and it was in fact radioactive.
Yeah, that's correct. It was very low level, but yeah, there was a time when people's dishware was stained with uranium.
Let's talk with a caller here. First up is in the town of community of Belgium, not far away from us, and over there in the next door county, and we'll go here to line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Sure.
I have a question in that the, originally the work with uranium, wasn't that refined from a thing called a pitch blend?
Yeah, that's a good question. The caller's referring to an ore called pitch blend, which is a form of uranium that is black in color. And this is the type of uranium, uranium oxide, that was mined out of the silver mines in the Middle Ages in what is now the Czech Republic. The literal translation of pitchblende is peckblende, which is German for bad luck rock, the rock of bad luck. And they called it this not because they were aware that it was radioactive, because when they came across the pitch blend, the peck blend, it meant that the silver was at an end, and that they were going to have to dig a new shaft, and no one wanted to do that.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. And that's 800-222-9455. Our guest is Tom Zollner, and he is the author of a recently published book, Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World. It is published by Viking Press, and the book's out now. And again, people have questions, so you certainly can call us. Well, maybe I'll ask you to tell the story a little bit of how it is you got interested in writing about uranium in the first place.
Yeah, I am not a nuclear physicist, certainly, not a geologist. I have no scientific training of anything worth mentioning. The reason why I became intensely interested in this particular rock was the result of having gone hiking out in southern Utah, near where I used to live, and noticing the remnants of mines on the canyon walls and not knowing what they were, and then learning that that had been the site, you know, vast portions of southern Utah had been the site of a uranium frenzy in the 1950s, when it was a national security imperative for the United States to, you know, develop as much of this as we could to build up our nuclear arsenal, and it just seemed such a paradox to me that, you know, such a ghostly landscape should produce such an eerie mineral, and I realized that I knew very little about what it was that that made nuclear weapons work, mm-hmm. and very little about the substance that had so drastically changed the world and so drastically changed the way that we think about military strategy and also the way that humanity conceives of the apocalypse, of the end times. Nuclear weapons brought that understanding into an urgent direction in the 1940s, and I think we still haven't lost that sense of that there is a rational, scientific means of the apocalypse at hand.
You know, having you said you weren't a nuclear physicist, and neither am I, and there would be a lot of the people who are listening, but I wonder if it's possible to talk a little bit about uranium in a way that would make sense to people like me who aren't. If people will remember when they were last in a chemistry class, maybe, and they remember this, the table that lays out all the elements, the periodic table, there would have been a time when uranium was the end. That was that, and in terms of what occurred in nature, that was it. There's other stuff that people have made, and that's why it is we have 118 of them now. But at one time, 92 uranium, that was it. Is there something particularly special or unusual or interesting about uranium that makes it possible to do the kind of things that we have, particularly that to use it in a way that unleashes this stunning amount of energy that can be used as a weapon?
Certainly. And you're right that it used to anchor the far end of the periodic table. You know, the elements used to go no further. That was Ni plus ultra. That was the heaviest, element that occurs naturally, and that still is true. There are elements that are beyond uranium called the transuranics, but none of them occur with any mentionable substance in nature. There's small amounts of plutonium that are here and gone, but the vast majority of plutonium, in fact, all plutonium that's used in nuclear power and in nuclear weapons, is synthetic, if you like. It was sort of brought into the earth through man's intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And so you asked, what makes it special? What makes it vulnerable to chain reaction? And what it is the nucleus, the heart of the atom, the protons and the neutrons there are bound together with invisible coils that are on the verge of breaking. The nucleus is built too large, in a sense. It seems to brush up against an invisible limit in nature, and it's a wobbly sort of very unstable nucleus, aching to gain some sort of balance. And to do that, it's throwing off little chunks of itself, these protons and neutrons. And, these are flying out of the nucleus at a high rate of speed, enough to circle the globe twice in 1 second. This is radioactivity.
Although, then, again, I wouldn't want to make the point that it's doing that, and it's throwing off pieces of itself, and what happens is that it, in this process, it changes into other things, and it becomes other elements as it loses these parts. That this process is a natural process, and it doesn't throw off so much radiation, and that's it's problematic in the sense like it doesn't throw off radiation like an atomic weapon throws off radiation.
That's right. And it's a slow process that it does become something else. You know, this is the half-life, as it's called, which in uranium's case is 4.7 billion years. So it takes a long time for this stuff to decay.
Mm-hmm.
It's stable. But what you do to create a nuclear explosion, and this is, I want to make clear, no great secret here, this is not revealing anything that hasn't been public knowledge for decades. But what you do to make a nuclear weapon is isolate what's called U-235. That's the particular isotope of uranium that is particularly unstable. And the way that you acquire this U-235 is you enrich uranium. This is what Iran has been trying to do for more than a decade. And you're separating out that U-235 through very expensive means. And you cluster enough of this U-235 together into a chunk and slam it together with another chunk of U-235, and that creates a chain reaction. It creates the shattering of all of these nuclei in a fraction of a second, releasing a tremendous amount of energy.
Mm. So just, I have a caller here I want to get right to, but you talked about the fact, you know, that there is this natural decay process of uranium, and eventually what happens is, given the time, that uranium will become lead. And although the half-life here is over 4 billion years, I think you said, so it would take a long time. But theoretically, does that mean, given enough time, that then there won't be any more uranium?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, uranium is a visitor to the planet. 4.7 billion years happens to be actually the age of the Earth. So we are sort of on the fulcrum of uranium's time here. It predates the forming of the Earth. Uranium was created inside supernovas before this molten ball of Earth hardened and cooled.
All right. Well, let's talk with a caller here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering whether you looked into the controversy regarding depleted uranium. Now, I know enough physics to know that the depleted uranium is created by, it's sort of the leftover of a process, and that seems to be important. There are many people that suggest that depleted uranium is dangerous. It's used as a just for its inert heaviness, actually. There are physicists who say, well, the reason we call it depleted is because we've taken out the most active part of it, which is the U-235 as opposed to 238. But I've heard that some German scientists are suggesting that the reason why it's still radioactive and dangerous is because of what I'll call its provenance. It actually comes from processes that have been used where it's been milled in various fashions, so that it contains other transuranics even, and there are traces of plutonium in it, people are suggesting. And you know about this. Well, why don't I hear what you...
Well, I mean, the military has used DU, depleted uranium, for armor-piercing shells, for mortars, for tank armor, and so forth. We've left a lot of this stuff scattered around Iraq, and the level of radioactivity it emits is actually quite low. The reason people get sick from it is an effect similar to that of lead poisoning. This is a matter of controversy just how dangerous it is, but there's a school of thought that the sickness comes from what it does to the blood. Beyond any radioactive properties that it has.
Well, but there is what I'm suggesting is there is this other line of argument that suggests that because it was milled out of a military process, as it were, it contains supposedly some byproducts that aren't. That you wouldn't say that it's just depleted uranium. You would say
yes. Well, that is a matter of accurate physics. You're right. I mean, this is the tailings left over from fission. That is to say that after that 235 has been fissioned away, it does leave behind a range of transuranics and other elements in there. So it's not just uranium going on. So you're correct in that assertion.
Right. So that means that the people that are saying this can't be a problem are just not really being, I would say, scientifically credible. I guess that's the major point I wanted to make, that you have to look at the actual detail of these things to actually understand it. It's easy to have a scientist say, well, this is the bad stuff's been taken out, but there are other things in there that that are dangerous, so it's a complexity that the people that are suffering from it, and we have an authority on it in Rantoul, who may be on the other line to talk about DU further, so thanks a lot.
Yes, my pleasure.
We are at a point here where we need pause. We'll continue to talk with our guest, Tom Zollner, about his book, Uranium. First, though, what we want to do is, again, take a minute or two just to remind people that we're here right at the beginning of our spring membership fundraising campaign. And what we're doing is we're hoping to make sure that this program, Focus 580, and other shows that are important to you are here tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that. That is ultimately what we're here all about. We hope that by the time that the drive is finished, and that'll be next week, we have actually shrunk the drives. We're spending less time on the air asking for money than we have in past years. And we do that because, well, we want to bring you the shows. But occasionally we do have to sit here in front of the microphones and say, folks, we need you to contribute the money to keep the station going. So we hope by the time that we're finished, we will have raised at least $200,000. You can help us right now by giving us a call. The number is 217-244-9455. Not the number to call in on this show. It's a little different. It's close, but it's a little different. 217-244-9455. And you can make a contribution. And here in the studio with me is one of our producers, Martha Thiel.
You know, one of the best things about WILL Radio and Focus 580 is that we tell you all sides of the story. And in particular, when you listen to a show like Focus, not only do we tell you all sides, maybe not in every show, but we can give you that in depth. It's not just a soundbite here and a soundbite there that leaves you saying, wait a minute, was that news or did I learn anything? And we really value our ability to do that. And we believe that the $200,000 we invest to keep you connected is money well spent. So please support what we do in keeping you connected and sustaining our programming by calling 217-244-9455 or going to willpledge.org. You can decide the amount.
And yeah, and that's something we really, I think is really important here and we really want to get across is that every contribution matters. Whether that is $20 or $50 or $150 or $250
or $1,000.
Or $1,000. You know, some people, for example, might say, well, you know, I listen to the station every day and I could actually give you a dollar a day, $365. Some people would say, you know, I could give you a dollar a week. That's $52. That really doesn't matter. That's up to you. But again, I want to say it again. Every dollar matters and everyone's contribution matters. Because we're not just working on a dollar goal, we're also working on a people goal to get as many people as supporters of WIL as possible, particularly folks who have not supported us in the past. So that's what it's all about. And it's really pretty simple and straightforward. And so that's why we're asking people to make the call or to go online. Again, it's 244-9455, or you can go to willpledge.org and make a contribution that way.
You know, people say they contribute for a lot of reasons. They value what they get out of the station. Think about the weather coverage you get from us. Where else can you get that kind of thing? Other people want to support an alternative to commercial stations, and some say they feel obligated to contribute because of all the listening they do. Well, for whatever reason, AM 580 serves the community. Whether it's in a crisis, lead up to an election, we're here providing information that the community needs. Please call 217-244-9455 and make a contribution, not just for you, but for the whole community.
We are at the midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and let me introduce again our guest, Tom Zollner. He's the author of this book that we're talking about here this morning. The title of the book is Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World. It's published by Viking Press. He's also the author of another book that's about diamonds. The title of that book is The Heartless Stone, A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire. It was named a notable book by the American Library Association in 2006. He's worked as contributing editor at Men's Health and also as reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. So if you're interested in reading his books, you can head out to the bookstore, head out to the library. Also here on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number to call. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, we do also have a toll-free line, and that is good for, you know, no matter where you are, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Well, and I think one of the things that you did in the process of writing the book is do some traveling and go to some places where they mine uranium. Maybe I'll ask you about Africa, because you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there's uranium in Canada, and people have mined uranium in the United States. I think, though, it's true that the uranium that was used to produce the first atomic weapons here in the United States didn't come from the United States. It came from Africa.
That's right. Almost none of the uranium in the original devices that we used came from primarily Africa, and a little of it from Canada, and a small portion of it from Colorado.
Hmm. Well, what was it like? You know, you went to the I guess what would have once been the Belgian Congo is no longer that. You went there. You went to see uranium mining actually on the ground there.
Yeah, this is the pit from which we acquired through a secret contract with the then exiled government of Belgium, a monopoly corporation called Union Minière. That we acquired that uranium for the Hiroshima weapon, and this mine still exists. It's closed, supposedly. It has been closed officially since 1960, but illicit mining still goes on there. Hardscrabble mining that happens. Guys who live around this pit who dig out copper and cobalt and sell that on an informal basis, and what also happens is some uranium ore is leaving that pit and is being sold to unknown buyers.
Mm. Conditions, you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that maybe now conditions for uranium miners are better than they once were, but that certainly there are hazards. Over time, it seems that the need to produce this material seemed, at least in the minds of some governments and some producers, to outweigh the health interests of the people that were involved in doing it. And I think to the point that slave labor was actually employed to get it out of the ground.
Yeah, this is another unfortunate legacy of uranium, particularly in Africa. And it would depend on, of course, how you would define slavery. The conditions were brutal, and when you signed up as a contract laborer there in the early part of the century at some of these uranium mines, it often left you with without much of a choice as to when you were going to leave. And so there was debt bondage involved. There was a little thought given to keeping these guys safe. And by all accounts, these were not pleasant places to work.
Mm. Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Urbana here, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Thanks for the book. Was there something to do with the American Indian reservations and mining in the United States, mining uranium? Also, I'd like to know: could you talk about the spent uranium pools of spent uranium in reactors in the United States and the danger of that? I mean, I know the Yucca Mountain thing has never. It seems like that's an endless government bureaucracy. But are they ever going to actually use Yucca Mountain? Are they going to store this stuff or central locate it or whatever? Could you talk about that for a minute? Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, good questions both. Mm-hmm. The caller's right that Indian reservations in the United States, particularly the Navajo Reservation in Arizona, have been rich in uranium. And, a lot of the mining that went on in the 50s and 60s was damaging both to the landscape and also to the Navajo who were employed to do the work. So lung cancer was almost unknown on the reservation in those days until uranium mining came along. And that's an unfortunate legacy. The Navajo have banned uranium mining on their land, which happens to be the largest Indian reservation in the United States. So yes, there is an intertwinement between the two, and the second part of the question about the storage of high level waste. Yes, Yucca Mountain now appears as though it's not going to happen. The geology of that site was never as good as its proponents had claimed, and we are now currently storing spent uranium rods on site at our 103 operating reactors, as well as in several dozen temporary storage facilities.
Yeah.
So, it's safe to do so in the short term, But in the long term, we still don't have an answer as to what we're going to do with this stuff.
It's a story that here on the program, on and off over the years, we have followed and tried to periodically get back to and look at. And certainly, as you say, there all along have been some questions raised about the geology of Yucca Mountain, and then also the people there in Nevada. I don't think that they ever wanted it. There was also always a great deal of public sentiment against it. So do you think that means that essentially we're back to the drawing board on what we're going to do in terms of long term storage of highly radioactive waste?
Yeah, we are, and you know, the caller had asked about Indian reservations and uranium. You know, there have been some tribes who have come forward and offered to become a repository for various levels of nuclear waste, and you know, this is a solution that obviously is extremely controversial.
Yeah.
And we don't have an idea of what we're going to do with this stuff over the long term. I mean, I think with Yucca Mountain, it's an isolated site, you know, away from population centers, and I think that the emotionalism surrounding that, the sense of, well, it's the desert, you know, we can just dump it off there and you know, it'll hurt no one. You know, the spectacular isolation of Yucca Mountain may have contributed, in my view, towards thinking of it as being a lot safer than it actually was.
Mm-hmm. For people who are concerned about proliferation, the knowledge associated with building a nuclear weapon, there, you know, that's definitely out. There's no way to put that one back in the box. Apparently, that's commonly accessible. The thing that's much more difficult is getting your hands on enough fissionable material to make a bomb. That's more difficult. Although there is stuff already existing in the world, and the issue of security is a concern. How much fissionable material, things that you actually could use to make a bomb if you could get your hands on it, is there in the world? Is there an answer to that question?
That's still a question mark, and you know, I think it's worth pointing out here that you know, uranium is more than just a key component in an atomic bomb. Uranium is an atomic bomb. That's really all it takes to create a chain reaction is highly enriched uranium. That's it. And so, therefore, you know, control of this stuff becomes very important. And we, the United States, despite what we thought were rigorous accounting procedures since the end of World War II, we don't have an exact handle on how much highly enriched uranium we created. And the situation is even worse in the former Soviet Union, where record keeping was all over the place. And so that would be one of the more likely routes for a group, either a religious cult or some sort of you know, politically revolutionary organization, to get a hold of the makings of an atomic bomb, would be simply to steal highly enriched uranium from most likely the former Soviet Union.
Yeah. So it seems that it's yes, you could, if you could get your hand on uranium and you could do the processing, you could do that. But it seems that it's much easier to let somebody else do that, essentially, and then get your hands on the material.
That's right.
Once it's already ready to go.
That's right. Enrichment is a very difficult process. It not only takes, you know, extraordinary scientific capabilities. It takes just so much electricity, so much working capital, the ability to hide such a facility from spy satellites, the ability to do this without anyone noticing is almost impossible.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about the fact that over human history, people have been aware of uranium and something of its properties, and they have done different things with it. Also, you talked about the fact that the German name for the ore means bad luck rock. And in the process of mining, once people got it, as far as they were concerned, it was just junk.
Right.
And they just tossed it in a pile out of the way. At what point, though, did someone decide it was worth taking a closer look at this and then really get onto the idea, essentially, of radioactivity?
Well, what an irony of history, first of all, that, you know, as you accurately say, junk, you know, should become so important. You know, that's just a plot twist in the history of man that I think is fascinating. It was in the early part of the century when scientists at Cambridge, in particular a professor named Frederick Soddy, realized that there was a source of energy within radium, which is a decay product of uranium that was constant. That was potentially limitless, and had nothing to do with any external factors such as sunlight or fire. That it was a reaction that was not a chemical reaction, and that there was something shining within that radium. It's worth pointing out too that his work attracted the notice of a science fiction writer who everyone knows, H.G. Wells. Who was the first person in history to use the phrase atomic bomb. And he did so in a novel written in 1914 called The World Set Free. And, this novel centers around this substance, this sort of fictional substance that everyone is trying to get their hands on that's going to either destroy the world or save it. And, this novel happened to have the science more or less correct. As to what was going on inside this mineral. And one of the fathers of the Manhattan Project, a guy by the name of Leo Szilard, used to pass this novel around in the early 1930s when he was trying to get people to pay attention to the potential of uranium. And so this was a case where science fiction actually was getting ahead of the news.
Yeah. Well, for those people who were some of the first researchers who did experimentation with radioactivity, they weren't thinking about this as a weapon, or maybe in the back of their minds they were, but certainly they were thinking that it would it have some positive applications. What sort of things for these researchers early on who were working with radioactivity, what did they think you could do with it?
Well, the military use and the peaceful use, for lack of a better term, have always been intertwined. This is one of the really sort of unfortunate aspects of uranium, is that it's hard to separate these processes. Early on, it was perceived as a way to as Soddy said, keep the lights of London lit for a year with just a very tiny amount of radium, powering ships across the ocean, which it does today, actually. All of these sort of utopian, uses for this inexhaustible source of energy that happens to come from the falling apart of this dirt in the ground. This is the paradox of uranium: is that the process used to enrich this stuff for the generation of electricity happens to be the same process that you enrich it for the tremendous destructive powers that it has.
Yeah. The people who were early on did experimentation with radioactivity weren't, I don't know when they became aware that this, just how hazardous this could be to human health, but certainly they worked with this material without much of anything in the way of protection. When did people realize that handling radioactive material actually was dangerous?
Well, both Marie and Pierre Curie were sickened by uranium and radium, mm-hmm. Radiation poisoning, mm-hmm. And so it was known as World War II, was going on, and we began embarking on the Manhattan Project. The deleterious effects became more and more clear as that was happening. And that's another irony of history too, I want to point out, that these rapid fire scientific discoveries about what was going on inside uranium happened to coincide with a huge global conflagration of World War II. Every belligerent nation involved in that conflict was working on this project. Germany had its own version of a Manhattan Project, as did Japan, as did Russia, as did France, even. And it's interesting to speculate what would have happened had these discoveries occurred during a time of greater stability.
Hmm. Here in the United States, this work was done under very conditions of very high security. But also, as you say, the United States was not the only country that was doing experimentation on this. Did people here in the United States actually think that somehow, though, that was something that you could keep the lid on? That is the expertise, the know-how to produce a nuclear weapon.
That was the supposition that we could not only control the knowledge, but that we could control the uranium. And so during the war, the Manhattan Project, the chief of the Manhattan Project, a guy by the name of Leslie Groves, sent teams of geologists all over the world to make assessments of the various uranium deposits located in each country and the likelihood that the U.S. could secretly control them after the war. This proved to be a Sisyphean task. I mean, there's no way that you can, hoard all of the world's uranium. But this was seen as an early way to ensure an atomic monopoly.
We have maybe about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Tom Zollner. His new book here that we're talking about is Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World. It's published by Viking. We have somebody calling in here where we are in Urbana. They are on a cell phone, so we want to get to them. Line one. Hello.
Hi, David. I'll just ask a quick question and listen on offline for the answer. You were talking a minute ago about the problem of nuclear waste, particularly spent fuel rods and things like that. And I was just wondering if there's any serious research being done on turning that waste into a resource. If the stuff is still radioactive, then I assume there's still energy in there. And I'm wondering about that. Thanks.
Yes. Right. Yes. What we do in the United States is we use only 5% of that fuel rod. And then throw the rest away. This is a controversy called reprocessing. Other nuclear nations, in particular France, will keep running that fuel rod through the reaction process over and over and over again and squeeze every last drop of usability out of that uranium. The reason that we don't do this and haven't since the late 1970s is because of a fear that the plutonium that's created out of those continuous reactions will be diverted, in nuclear lingo, it will be stolen by those who are going to possibly use it as a weapon. And so we don't squeeze much juice out of the orange, so to speak. And so this is more than research. This is actually standard operating procedure in most countries except the United States.
Yeah, and the worry is, again, this goes back to the proliferation issue. The concern is that some people say, well, we don't want to produce more material that could potentially be used in some kind of a nuclear weapon.
That's right. I mean, my personal belief is that fear is misplaced, that there's nothing inherently dangerous about reprocessing because plutonium is so difficult to work with, if you're not a nation state. And so, for me, what frightens me a lot more about the spread of nuclear weapons is the uranium, actually. I think plutonium, that fear is overblown.
Yeah. We're coming down to the point where we're going to have to stop. It seems that a natural question, and it's a controversial subject, obviously, and something we've talked about, and I'm sure we will continue to talk about, is whether there is a future in this country to some sort of renaissance in the offing for nuclear generation of electricity. The reason we raise the question is people are very concerned with the problem of global warming and our reliance on fossil fuels, and that there are some people who argue, well, the way to get around that is for us to go even more into producing electricity by using nuclear generation. And, of course, the other side of that is people say, well, that's not such a good idea. We end up with a very dangerous byproduct that we have to figure out what we're going to do with. There are other problems associated with nuclear energy, and it's just not something that we want to do. And that seems to be where the debate is right now. And I wonder, where you think that that's likely to go. I mean, will it continue to be something of a stalemate like that? Or does one of the other sides here have something of an upper hand in the debate?
I'll make two quick points here. And these are points which, sort of are opposition with one another. The first is you're correct in that nuclear power is ironically, it turns out to be a very green technology when it comes to climate change. It emits no greenhouse gases, which, you know, that's very attractive. And in that sense, yes, it is clean, a lot cleaner than we had bargained for. But in opposition to that, this is also a truism, which is that nuclear power is far from cheap. Nuclear power advocates like to call this inexpensive, but it really isn't. There's a reason why we haven't built a new reactor in this country in 30 years, and it comes down to the economics. They cost about $10 billion each. They take a long time to build, and it's really not that good of a deal economically. And so, you know, that's something that has to be considered. Mm.
Well, there, I think we're going to have to finish up. There's certainly much more in this book is there available for people who want to take a look at it. The book, again, the title of the book is Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World. It's published by the Viking Press by our guest, Tom Zollner. You'll go looking for the book, by the way. He spells his name Zoellner. You also might like to look at his book, Heartless Stone. That's about diamonds. And he is the co-author also with Paul Rusesa Bagina of the book An Ordinary Man, so you could look at that as well. He's been a contributing editor at Men's Health, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, joining us this morning by phone. Mr. Zollner, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.